So it's now my immense pleasure to be able to introduce two of the greatest heroes of my life, Ralph Nader and Bill McKibben. And I do so while apologizing. We will only have them with us for an hour, but we're grateful for the hour. No two people have made a greater mark or been a greater inspiration to public action against environmental and social catastrophe, or been as tireless in their quests. Each of them will speak for 20 minutes or so in turn, and then we'll take questions before they have to leave. So the questions will come from this mic over here. So if you have a question, don't line up now. Just wait until it's time for the questions. So after a toss of the coin, Ralph will go first. Ralph Nader's a man whose wisdom, power, bravery, breadth, and effectiveness have been such an inspiration to me and taught me so much for 50 years. And the rest of you, too. I've known Ralph much longer than he's known me. By the time I was in college, his great book, Unsafe at Any Speed, was already out and a bestseller and launched the first mass consumer movement against automobiles, for sure, in the world. So that's a model for the rest of us. He was criticizing technology and winning in many areas before I even thought there was a problem. Together with his activist followers and Nader's Raiders, Ralph showed immense leadership on battles on democracy issues, social issues, health issues, with great effectiveness for a half century, and running for president five times, which we'd all didn't love always, but it shows his commitment and passion for the issues. I didn't get to know him personally until the 1980s when I started working against economic globalization. He had already founded the most activist and important anti-globalization group, Public Citizen, which still exists today. It's such a pleasure to have him with us today, and he's here right after publishing another fantastically Nader-ish style book called Unstoppable, The Emerging Left-Right Alliance to Dismantle the Corporate State, which we have out in the bookstore, which is an argument that the left and the right ought to get together against corporations, which perhaps he'll tell us why. So thank you. Here's Ralph Nader.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Jerry Mander, and everybody who made this happen. It takes a lot of work, a lot of detail, and I think you showed the fruits of all your labors, so this is very good. I can't but comment. Did you know this is the lectern that Abraham Lincoln spoke on? No, the very lectern.
That's the actual lectern.
Yeah, yeah.
That's the actual lectern, the physical thing.
Yeah. And it's good to be with Bill McKibben. Nobody I know has ever gotten people say a lot of things about Bill McKibben, like he gives more blurbs than anybody in history on books, and he educates people on climate change, and he networks. But in my book, there's nobody I ever have heard of that can get 1,300 people arrested around the White House protesting global. The Greens are lucky if they can get 1,300 people at their convention. All right. I'm going to make a number of startling declarations. The first one is that in many of the areas covered in this symposium, it's easier than we think to turn them around. And one of the great assets of corporate power is the feeling by its victims that they have no power, they're discouraged, they're demoralized, so why even try, why even show up? And if we can overcome that by allusions to American history where very few people started major movements against slavery, women's right to vote, farmer, labor, all the populist progressive efforts, they all started with a tiny number of people. And when they prevailed years later, there never were that many people even at the end of the victory line. There never were more than a few thousand people. And so it behooves us to ask the question, just what does it take to start the dynamics to turn something around? Well, the first one is to learn that that's always how it happens, as Margaret Mead said. It always happens with a few people. And the second thing is that historically, when you see the various problems that were challenged, tobacco, lead, asbestos, unsafe automobiles, etc., they all follow a certain pattern. And the pattern is that first the technology is developed and marketed, and second, the corporate promoters develop a veil of secrecy around any possible contrary scientific challenge. They ally themselves with the state in order to get subsidies and in order to make sure there aren't congressional hearings and in order to make sure the right people are in office. They engage in massive, low sensual deception. That is, they sell the products in order to reduce knocking in your engine, in order to make you concentrate better when you smoke, in order to develop psychosexual illusions when you're driving a car. The marketing is extremely clever that way. And all this buys them time, 10 years, 15 years, 20 years. And as a result, the main area they're most concerned about is a scientific backlash. This is why they're so ferocious against the science that is so overwhelming on climate change. And so I think it's very important to draw a distinction and turn it into the public dialogue, the difference between corporate science and academic science. Corporate science is not peer-reviewed, think Monsanto, not peer-reviewed. It's secret, proprietary, trade secrets, whatever words they use. It's politically powerful, Monsanto's power in Washington against labeling GMO foods, for example. It's international. It is driven by narrow commercial pursuits. That is, there are technologies that can be for the people, and there are similar technologies based on similar science that can provide all kinds of trivial me-too pharmaceuticals or trivial technologies of distraction and the like. But above all, corporate science has to crush academic science. Academic science, ideally, is open, it's peer-reviewed, it's self-critical, it keeps options open for revision, it has a public interest or public service mission, and it accumulates its findings in public to solicit criticism. Well, guess who's winning? In our universities and colleges, corporate science is moved in. Where it isn't dominant, it co-opts, it provides consultancies, it provides research, money, sometimes endows professorships, MIT, Stanford, etc. You have Novartis right on the campus in Berkeley. You have an oil company on the campus in Berkeley. And so academic science has lost a great deal of its ability to challenge. And one reason is that we don't make that distinction. We don't make that distinction between corporate science and academic science in order to develop a clarity of purpose. Because underneath all these technologies are phony science and technology and secrecy and distortion and suppression and censorship and going after whistleblowers and the like. Having said that, my experience is that, as Abraham Lincoln said, with the public sentiment, you can do anything. Without the public sentiment, you can't. Today's words are public opinion. And we have enormous consensus in this country on major redirections, including those in technology. To wit, look what happened when people started learning about lead-contaminated children and infants and tobacco and cancer and heart disease and being killed in 15-mile-an-hour collisions, unsafe cars, etc. As long as you have public sentiment, all you need is less than 1% of the population organized at a level of a civic hobby, focused, say, on Congress, if that's the target, a civic hobby that is less than most hobbies in their own life. That is, it's less than a bowling league fanaticism, and certainly less than the serious bird watchers. But by that I mean about 200 hours a year. And if you had 2,000 people in each congressional district pledging 200 hours a year and raising $200 a year to open up two offices full-time in every congressional district, and you wrap that around several redirections, you don't even have to specialize in one, and you focus it on Congress, 36 months, you win. Nothing can stop the combination of the laser beam and perceived public opinion. That is why I am very insistent that we become strategically clarifying about any kind of effort to make technologies accountable, to make them appropriate, to substitute them, to stop them, to redirect them, to reshape them, whatever is needed in all the symposium's topics in the last 2 days. I mean, nuclear power has got to be eliminated, not shaped or temporized. GMO, with all their claims, there's no evidence that there's higher crop yields. There's no evidence that it's better nutrition. It's one of the greatest hoaxes in the 20th century. But it was sold through political power, by crushing independent research, by litigating anybody who even tried to use or obtain genetically modified seeds in a scientific laboratory to analyze it or analyze it in the field. Monsanto at work again. So any movement that tries to make technology more accountable, you can see three stages. This is after the technology is installed and it's increasingly perceived to be harmful in a whole variety of ways. The first is exposure. And for all you say about our generation, we live in the golden age of exposés, books, magazines, videos, and a golden age of documentaries. And that doesn't mean that they have much impact. They don't have that much impact. I think most documentaries are seen theatrically by about 50,000 people in the United States. That's considered a good turnout. Books, you know how hard it is. You get terrific books exposing one industry after another. It's lucky if they sell 10,000 copies. E-books or print books. So what you're seeing here is an atrophy of distribution and readership or viewership, even though 10 times more muckraking books come out in a year now than in the 1950s or 1960s, not to mention the documentaries. Now, why is that? They're very well done. They do appeal to human interest. They have good sound and light and good editing and vibrant examples of people in Appalachia or people in the ghettos or people trying to protect their children from getting leukemia, from toxic exposure, and so on. I mean, why is that? Well, that's because it doesn't link sufficiently with the second stage, which is prescription. And yet we live in the golden age of prescription. There are more proposals. You'll hear them today and you'll hear them tomorrow. You heard them from every speaker. We're a country that has more problems than it deserves and more solutions than it applies. I mean, do you want any more on-the-ground proposals than converting from fossil fuel and nuclear to solar and efficiency. It's here. It's on the ground. It's no longer just someone at Rensselaer saying it. Solar panels are a major growing industry in the country. Wind power. Warren Buffett's putting billions of dollars in wind power. He doesn't tilt at windmills, you know. He makes a lot of money. And yet, you see, there's still resistance. If you go to Washington, D.C., that is fossil fuel land on Capitol Hill and the Department of Energy. It's nuclear power land, regardless of what's going on around the country. There are programs for solar and efficiency, but the dominant power is still fossil and nuclear. All right, so that's the second stage. The third stage is what most people who do stage one and stage two fall down on. And once I went through over 100 muckraking books that I have on my shelf, just, you know, a Sunday afternoon, and I turned to the last page. This is investigative, expose, denunciation, prescription, and I turned to the last page, and it's like, only if the public wakes up will we be able to treat this problem. End of book. Now, one problem is it's not entirely the author's fault. It's the culture's fault. We're bored by solutions. Literally. You even when you talk on a TV program or a radio program that gives you something other than a sound bark, something other than a sound bite, they're all eyes when you're talking about the abuse. And when you start talking about the solution, time's up. They're bored. As a culture, we are bored with solutions. That wasn't always the case. When I was campaigning, my advisors, such as they were, when I got to the solution part, they always just say, cut it, cut it. What do you mean, cut it? Here's a facility to organize people to deal with the problem. How can I cut it? Right? Okay. Stage three is what we've got to focus on. Point one, it's easier than we think, far easier than we think. Point two, as long as we get public sentiment behind us, and it already is left-right on many areas. Try left-right on solar. The Koch brothers are trying to bribe legislators in southern legislatures to put a tax on solar panels because it's challenging their oil and gas industry. Guess what? They're losing. Left-right. Left-right on renewable. Left-right on energy efficiency. The problem with liberals and progressives is they can't get over the yuck factor. Yuck! Have to deal with these people? On prison reform, you have to deal with Grover Norquist? You have to deal with Newt Gingrich, who start this group right on crime and want to cut down on the sentences for possession, small possession of drugs? Yuck! So here's what really needs to be done, I think. We have to ask ourselves, and this, we're not very good at this, how many of us know enlightened billionaires? Bill does. Steyer. Okay? How many of us know enlightened billionaires? Give me $1 billion, and I'll get you fundamental tax reform, overcoming all lobbyists for corporate tax havens and corporate tax breaks in 36 months. Congressional district by congressional district with the public sentiment behind. You think just conservatives like tax havens? You know? Yeah, we like the idea that GE just made $15 billion and didn't pay a cent in federal income tax. No. We can't write off the left-right alliance that is already out there in public opinion. Some of it is going operational. 80% support restoring the minimum wage. 80%. It's a lot of conservative workers in places like Walmart. It's already going operational on Empire. It's going operational on the civil liberty restrictions of the Patriot Act. It's already gone operational successful in 15 legislatures on juvenile justice reform. And it will go operational. It was Andy Kimbrell and his allies who got these religious leaders to come down hard on genetic engineering. So enough said on that, but we really do have to get down to asking the question, how much does it take to make the change? I mean, how much does it take? Just the way a business says, how much investment and time and personnel and skill does it take to get this business on its way to operability? The differences that we see now are not that different than in the past. The struggles in the past against technologies and the extent to which they succeeded followed the same pattern. Public education, exposure, the proposals, and then organized. If you ask me how many full-time people pulled off the counterattack on tobacco, and which is on the defensive now, and we've gone from 44% adult smokers to less than 18% since 1965, I would say, and you don't see anyone smoking on airlines and buses and railroads and so on, I would say the people who pulled it off could be fit in this room nationwide. There are a few leading physicians, epidemiologists, politicians, media, authors, advocates, etc. And you can go through. How many did it on lead? Lead is a devastating effect to this day on people, kids who are exposed to it. Even fewer people. And we're talking at the end of the victory line, such as defined victory. So we ought to be very quantitative about this. How much money is it going to take? How many people? Where are they going to operate? What information are they going to be equipped with? And above all, how serious are they? We're not looking for concerned people. They're a dime a dozen. We're looking for serious people. People as serious in watching Congress as people are serious watching birds. Do I have to say, I have nothing against bird watchers. It's a wonderful hobby, but you have to admire them for their rigor, up at dawn, into the marshes, binoculars, pens, photos, internet relays. I got seven. How many do you have? Imagine, I got seven senators. How many do you have? Fine. So I want to end with a letter I wrote to Tom Steyer and Al Gore and George Soros, very big champions on climate change. And the letter basically said, you're very articulate, you've done a lot in this area in one way or the other, you're trying to get people elected, you're trying to wake people up, you're trying to fund groups. What are you doing about Congress? Well, Congress is now so stuck and ineffective that the exact opposite of what should have happened is happening. People have turned off and turned away. And the reaction from the staff of these people is, Congress is not where the action is. Well, Congress, as long as it exists, is where the action is. And if you cannot engage in a transformation of our technologies, there isn't a single group full-time going after the risks of nanotechnology. It's in 5,000 products. It's probably in some of your clothes right now. The portentousness of nanotechnology compares with the portentousness of changing the nature of nature based on commercial instincts, genetic engineering. And there isn't there. And there are no hearings, and there's no cliques in Congress on our side. And there's no focus on the executive branch to steer its procurement of technology into appropriate technology and sustainability. It's the biggest customer in the United States. And there's no one to connect the members of Congress back home with the activity you're doing all over the country on a lot of these issues. And we get a shrug. There isn't one person I know who wakes up in the morning, goes up on Capitol Hill from an environmental group, and just focuses on climate change, 100% of the time. They have pieces of it. They do deal with the coal issue, EPA, etc. But they've all become so discouraged. Why are they discouraged? We have at least 40% of the Congress on our side on climate change. So let's leave it with a vast burst of optimism that we fill the blanks in. It's easier than we think.
Thank you, Ralph. Bill McKibben. Right now we know him best as the most effective campaigner in maybe the whole world on climate change. A little organization that he started just a few years ago, 350.org, has just blossomed amazingly into a very, very powerful movement leader. And that organization was just started with 7 students of Bill's. I met these students quite a few years ago, and they were just like trying to figure out how you run campaigns and things like that. And they learned fast under Bill's leadership. That march a couple weeks ago had 350,000 people. 400,000 people. I don't know how many personally there were, but there were a hell of a lot of people. And they were expressing their pain and frustration and commitment. Now, how did he manage to build an organization on climate change so fast? I don't really know the answer to that, except that the truth was being told, and people realized it was the truth, and an enormous number of people are backing it now. And I think, as Ralph said, I think it has the kind of commitment that is required. Anyway, it's a testament to Bill's brilliance and passion, and I would say also his moral perseverance. And I'm incredibly impressed. I first knew Bill when he was a great writer. He was working for The New Yorker when I first started following him. His books have been amazing and important and so various. He's written, I don't know, 20 books or so, right, Bill? Maybe more. And so many different genres as well. You know, his books have been about climate, about media, about economics, population, agriculture, and they're all good. And, you know, I remember when my TV book was coming out, he stole my thunder by doing a book about TV called The Age of Missing Information, which is a very, very good book. And I got very mad at him at the time, although I didn't know him yet. In any case, among his newest book is called Oil and Honey. Another one is called Global Warming Reader. Then there's Earth, Deep Economy, The End of Nature, Long Distance, Hope. There are 15 or 18 more, and I won't name them all, but I'd like you to meet Bill McKibben.
Thank you all. Now, it is a pleasure. It's a pleasure for me to be here. It's true, the last time I was in New York was about a month ago, and it was with 400,000 of my closest friends. You know, that was a great day, that climate march, but marches are by their nature blunt, not subtle. The main messages that we got across were when we all fell silent for a minute, in memory of the people who've already suffered from climate change, and then when we made a big, loud noise and sounded the kind of alarm on the greatest crisis our planet's ever faced, and that was good, but blunt. Thanks to Jerry and all his crew, we now have the chance tonight to just, to talk a little more speculatively and a little more in depth. And so many of the people that I most admire in the world are here talking, people who I admire immensely for their activism and work, Vandana and my old friend Winona LaDuke, and you know, on and on and on, people whose writing I've learned an immense amount from. It was very good to see Pat Mooney up on the stage, who I've never actually met, but whose work I have cribbed over and over and over again, and Marcy Darnovsky, and you know, just dozens of people, and Helen Caldicott, and the whole crew. I want to talk a little philosophically for me, because these questions about techno-utopianism for me go back to the time that I was writing The End of Nature. It was my first book. It came out in 1989. In fact, it came out 25 years to the day before that march through New York. It was the first book about climate change, so part of it was reporting about the early science of global warming, what we knew then, which was exactly what we know now. If you burn a lot of coal and gas and oil, you're going to raise the temperature of the planet. We just didn't know how fast it was going to happen. So it was half that, but it was also half kind of amateur philosophy or lay theology or something about what it felt like to live in a world that was suddenly shifting in those kind of ways. And for me, the dominant emotion was, yes, there was a certain amount of fear, and you know, people have been reminding us all day of the reasons to be afraid of what is going on, of the impacts on our health and our economy and things. But really, for me, more the dominant emotion was sadness. This powerful sense that the world was changing in a very deep way, that there was no way to escape human beings any place on the planet, that the idea that there was something wild anymore was increasingly an illusion, because we filled every inch of the atmosphere with our byproducts. And those were some of the same ideas that carried over as in subsequent years I got to write with the help of Marcy and others about things like human genetic engineering and things. So let me begin with an observation. In the recent history of our species, especially since the Industrial Revolution, most of the story has been about human beings getting much larger in our abilities, in our impacts, in our shaping of the world around us. And in many ways, that's been a useful process. Things like fossil fuel allowed us to get richer and arguably healthier, at least in terms of public health, and so on and so forth. We began, however, to get a sense that we might be getting a bit too big sometime in the middle of the last century, sometime around the explosions, I think, of those first nuclear devices at Alamogordo, and it was Oppenheimer who, watching them, quoted from the Gita and said, "We are become as gods, destroyers of worlds." We've been able, because we can imagine what big nuclear explosions would look like, to so far head off that particular horror. But there are other things that we're doing as we grow in size that, though they seem more benign at a certain level, are just in their effect just as large but harder to imagine. It turns out, say, that the explosion of a billion pistons in a billion cylinders every minute around the world has effects as large as the explosion of nuclear weapons when it comes to changing the world around us. The amount of extra heat that the carbon we've emitted traps each day on the planet is the heat equivalent to 400,000 Hiroshima-sized explosions daily. Enough heat so far that we've been able to melt the summer Arctic, that we learned in May that the West Antarctic ice sheet is in a state of irrevocable melt, on and on and on. So these are, in the case of fossil fuel or of genetics, these are threshold problems. To a certain point, things are useful, and past that point, they're not. I'm used to thinking about threshold problems because I live in a college town in Middlebury, Vermont, which means I get to watch each year as the freshmen arrive and they discover early on that drinking two or three beers makes them feel good. And so they speculate that perhaps drinking 20 or 30 will make them feel 10 times better. And it turns out that that's not correct, that there is a point past which things begin to shift. Much the same, it turns out, for things like fossil fuel, which now present us with the greatest crisis that human beings have ever faced. Or, say, our understanding of human genetics, which at the beginning proved an enormous help in helping understand the tragedies that we face. And so there's no doubt why some of our great heroes, like David Suzuki, the great Canadian environmentalist, were early practitioners of genetic science, and also no doubt why they became uneasy with it at a certain point. Because when you begin to read and research about the plans of the leaders of this enterprise, many of them corporate, it comes to nothing short of remodeled human beings. As Lee Silver, the Princeton professor, put it, there's nothing that goes beyond tinkering, nothing that we can do that's beyond tinkering. Why not, he said, seize this power? Why not control what has been left to chance in the past? Why not improve the intelligence of the generations to come? But aside from the obvious sort of class implications and things, which even the proponents concede, think about the kind of world that that creates. Think about it with the same kind of imagination that we've brought to the aftermath of a, say, nuclear world. Think about what it would mean to engineer your first child to make them more intelligent, and then 5 years later, when it came time for your second child, to engineer them to be far more intelligent than the first, so that your first kid was, and your next forever marooned on a kind of island of technological obsolescence as we went forward. And for what? To what end? Simply to speed things up, to have more now, to be more advanced. We need, I think, to think harder about the tragedies that we should try to prevent and those that we should not. The tragedies that we should try to prevent obviously include things like illness and disability. And so it's good that we have somatic genetic engineering to help us deal with the painful conditions with which people are born, but as the engineers would say, it's dangerous to cross the germline and begin to remodel human beings in embryo and make them something different. We need to deal with the tragedy of huge disparities in wealth and power. It's so crucial, for instance, that the climate fight be in large part about extending energy to the poor world that needs it badly. I'm not going to show a bunch of pictures, although I have about a zillion 350.org pictures from the 20,000 rallies we've staged in every country on Earth except North Korea. Just know that most of your brothers and sisters in this fight are poor and black and brown and Asian and young, because that's what most of the world consists of, and they are fighting with great vigor. Last week, our brothers and sisters in the Pacific Island nations who had spent the summer building traditional canoes on 12 Pacific Island nations that'll disappear in the course of this century unless we get our act together. They took those canoes and they used them to blockade the largest coal port in the world in Newcastle, Australia, and it was an absolutely gorgeous day. It was beautiful to read this morning. I was in Bangladesh 10 years ago with a friend of mine who had installed the very first solar panel in that country. And we went to look at it on the roof of a school in a rural village. There was a story in today's paper about how Bangladesh may now lead the entire world in the installation of solar panels, that there are millions upon millions of people now able to do their homework or whatever it is once the night falls, because there are solar panels hither and yon across that country. We need to deal with the tragedies of sexism and racism and all their spawn, and we need to do it by building that kind of deep human solidarity that comes with movements. But there are other tragedies that we need to think more clearly about than we have. One of the things I figured out when I was writing this book called Enough about the genetic engineering world was that the tragedy that the ideologues behind it were dealing with was the tragedy of their own mortality, their inability to deal with the fact that they were going to die. And that's actually not a tragedy. That's part of who we are and what our societies rationally are about. There are people who worry a great deal that we lack a kind of total control of the world around us. But I think that smallness is, in fact, a place where we would be wise to kind of move back in the direction of. Imagine a world. Imagine a world fueled by renewable energy. Imagine a world fed by local food. Imagine a world where we traveled more via the internet than we did by jet. Imagine a world that kind of worked in those ways. The hardest word in the English language is probably enough. And yet we've been given such a beautiful planet on which to live, even now so beautiful, even that the bites we've taken out of it. The hardest concept for human beings in some ways is restraint. And yet it is our real gift. If you asked what it was that made human beings special the way that flight makes birds special, I think you could do worse than answer that we are the species that can decide not to do things that we are capable of doing, that can decide to back off and limit ourselves. And indeed, that's the advice I think that we've gotten from every spiritual tradition back at least as far as the Buddha. And certainly from our indigenous brothers and sisters who have emerged in the last few years at the absolute forefront of these fights, from the tar sands to everywhere else, the absolute key players in these fights. The idea that it is a human gift to rein oneself in, to think about generations to come. These questions go to the heart of who we are. Are we solely individuals or are we part of societies? And they also, and now here I think Ralph was exactly right, they're also questions that could and should cross some of the kind of boundaries of temperament that we often call ideology. It's a shame, in a sense, that we don't have a real conservatism left in this country, that conservatism has become simply a synonym for corporate interest, because it's useful to have people who help hold us back sometimes. If you think about it, an awful lot of what we're asking for in movements like the movement against climate change are very conservative. We're asking for a world much like the world that human beings inhabited for the last 10,000 years, the period of the Holocene. The most important thing that happened in the life of everybody in this room is that we moved out of the Holocene sometime in the last decade or two, when we took the temperature out of the bounds of which the planet had operated in the time of every human for which we have a record. Asking for the world to stay in somewhat recognizable form is somewhat conservative, and it is, if you think about it, oil companies that behave in a dangerous and even radical fashion in the world around us, that they are willing to alter the chemistry of the atmosphere, even past the point where scientists have told them what would happen, and past the point where they can watch the effects. That's a kind of dangerous utopianism. And if you look at the advertisements of the oil companies, a good way to look at them is to count the number of the more penguins there are per commercial, the more danger, the more trouble the companies are committing on our planet. That radicalism needs now to be checked by the kind of common sense that Ralph was talking about. I think these are the deepest possible questions that we face, and I am extraordinarily glad that you all are engaging them, and engaging them on many levels, on the practical and utilitarian, but also on the philosophical, because it's often on that level of the philosophical that we begin to find the common ground on which to push back against the very narrow, very vested, very special interests of the tiny part of humanity eager to cause huge change and the carnage that comes with it. So I am grateful to all of you for engaging these questions, and especially, Jerry, to you for bringing us all here. Thank you all very much.
Questions? Thank you so much. We have a few people asking questions now, so let's proceed. Just a moment. Can you move that mic close, talk right into the mic? Is the mic on over there? Yeah, okay. Talk right into it. Speak into it.
Hello.
Good. Now. Right.
In view of resource depletion, major sacrifices inevitably lie ahead. But in a world where everyone wants and feels entitled to the American dream, and the media carpet bomb them with promises they can have it, how do you get the message of sacrifice out to the public?
Well, I would just say I don't think it's sacrifice that we're talking about so much. One set of polling data that caused me to go write a book once was looking at the National Research Institute, one of the big polling firms. Every year since the end of World War II, one of the big polling firms has asked Americans, are you happy with your life? The percentage of Americans who say, yes, I'm very happy, peaked in 1956 and has gone downhill since, steadily. Now, I wasn't around in 1956, so I'm not sure what was so great then, but I have some sense of what happened in that period. It was the period of the great suburbanization of America that's proceeded apace. That suburbanization, of course, drove things like the use of fossil fuels through the roof, and caused much of the trouble that we face. It's hard to heat and cool everybody's, own kind of starter castle for entry-level monarch, out there. And the fact that they're all, quarter mile apart from each other makes it hard to, get around. But the real problem, I think, was that they drove a kind of human isolation. The average American has half as many close friends as they did in 1950. That is a very big change for a social primate. In living conditions, it's no wonder we're not as all-fired happy as we thought we might be with our big increases in the standard of living. And so part of the answer is we need to recover what it is that's not sacrifice but pleasure, and that has a lot to do with human contact and human community. One of the reasons I like building movements and one of the reasons that I liked seeing 400,000 people on the streets of New York a month ago was that my sense was everybody was having a hell of a good time, and that it was a deeply meaningful and pleasurable day for them and a lot more like it. So, our identification of ourselves primarily as consumers has been the nicest gift we ever gave to the corporations. We're much more than that. We're human beings, and we should stand up for it from time to time.
Yeah. It's really the diminishment of sacrifice. I mean, if you can use energy more efficiently, it saves you in the family budget, you breathe cleaner air, you have fewer greenhouse gases, fewer floods. I mean, it's just the opposite. You see, what's happened is corporations have define productivity and efficiency and happiness in their terms. We just got to turn it upside down. It's just the reverse. Yeah.
Yeah. Well,
saving lives in safer automobiles was not considered productive. See, but when we finally said, yeah, it is pretty productive. You have to look at the auto executives and the committees testifying in Washington. You say, if you save lives, they'll buy your cars. Dead people don't buy cars. It's just amazing how they control the language, and they call themselves providers, the private sector, white-collar crime, job creators. What's his name in Berkeley? Lakoff said that there should be a phrase called "workers are the profit creators." So he turns it right around.
We've all seen the statistics about polling on happiness, and the United States, which is among the richest countries in the world, is, 35th or so in terms of happiness. I don't know the exact number, but Helena Nurberg-Hodge is going to have an Economics of Happiness conference right at this room here in a couple of weeks, so some of you should check that out.
You should definitely go, because Helena is the been thinking about this longer than any person on the face of the earth, I think. Helena has been thinking about it longer than anyone and more productively. And that's
so that's going to be right here, so some of you should look that up. Next question.
November 8th.
I recently saw a film called Cowspiracy. And I thought for most of my life, recycling and standing up for cleaner energy was important. But in this film, he presented, the director and who's in the film, presented a number of facts that I found surprising, that the pesticides, herbicides, fungicides, the silos, the slaughterhouses, everything else that goes along with producing the meat that is eaten around the world, contributes 51% of the pollution. And he went to Greenpeace because they didn't have anything on their website, went to Sierra Club because they are driven by membership donations. And that one hamburger, it took 1,000 gallons of water to make one hamburger. And I've been off meat for 45 years, since I was 19. And so it's always been, it's for me, I just don't want to kill anything. But I'm concerned, and I'd like to get some whether these facts that he had were, he talked about the dead zones in the ocean and 1,000 or an acre per second disappearing in the Amazon, the lungs of the earth. And just so that I'm not misled by one film, but in terms of composting, recycling, but now it's, I used to shudder if somebody threw a piece of paper in the trash can. Wait, that goes in recycling. And now it's like, how do we get the planet to stop eating cattle, especially?
So the question about how to get the planet to stop eating cattle, especially factory farm cattle, is a really powerful one. So there's several ways you could do it. You could have a campaign to go around and convert everyone to veganism. And if you want to do it, more power to you, and some of us will help. My sense is, from spending a lot of time out around the whole world, that tons of people are coming into the countries, are coming into the place where they're eating meat for the first time, and they're enthusiastic about it. And I think it's going to be a hard campaign to win. That, and I think that in general, it raises the useful point about whether the thing we're most worried about or should be working hardest on is trying to get individual change or structural change. My thought around climate change in general is that structural change is the key here. Given the short amount of time we have, and given the relatively small percentage of the population that we have invested in this fight, that the wisest use of those people is a political force to change those structures. Above all else, to put a price on carbon so that you're no longer allowed to pour it into the atmosphere if your Exxon use it as an open sewer. The day that that happens, I think, is the day when factory farming will face the greatest challenge it ever faces, far greater than it faces really from veganism or something. It's deeply, deeply wedded to the use of cheap fossil fuel, and without it, it founders and we head in new directions. It's not that one shouldn't eat lower on the food chain, one should. It's not that one shouldn't change your light bulbs. I mean, I've changed mine all twice now. They're all compact fluorescents, and now they're LEDs. It's all good to do each of these things, but when you're doing it, don't fool yourself into thinking that you're stopping climate change by doing it. The most important thing that individuals could do is to not be individuals, to come together into movements that can change the structure. So thank you. It's a good
thank
question.
You. Well, okay, next question.
My name's Jesse Henshaw. I'm a physicist. Spent my lifetime studying growth as a natural phenomenon. And I noticed Ralph's comment that people have become bored with solutions, and I hear people suggesting a lot of solutions, but also they've become bored with the complexity of them, and it's really hard to maintain conversations. But when they propose solutions, they address their values, but having included in in the discussion, usually it comes up that money is actually the real problem. Why don't we propose changing the use of money to globally multiply all the problems and address them all at once, to go to the heart of the issue? Now, I'm proposing that partly just as a puzzle, because it is a profoundly neglected subject, at very much the center of our whole system of problems, all our converging crises. But also just seriously, why don't we look at a central solution that would make the Earth profitable again instead of ever more unprofitable?
Ralph?
Yeah, that's a very good point. If you have too many solutions and micro solutions in all kinds of sectors in our life, you do get people confused. I think one way to answer your question is local self-reliance, community self-reliance, community businesses, local renewable energy, local food. Because the more local the gap is between seller and buyer, the more accountability there's going to be. I mean, when you don't know who's producing your food, who's producing your iPhone, who's producing your cars thousands of miles away and sweatshops in China and elsewhere, you don't know how the workers are being treated. It just, as Wendell Berry pointed out in a brilliant essay on this, it destroys not only the sense of community and interchange, it destroys morale. It reduces people to powerless widgets in a global corporate chain. So I think that's the theme. Yes Magazine is a very good magazine that chronicles what's going on in community health, food, energy, shelter, transportation at the local level. And it's reached tens of billions of dollars. And the more that the local community businesses grow, the fewer dollars are put in the hands of Bank of America, Pfizer, Hotel Hospital Chain of America, and ExxonMobil, etc. That's the way to displace, at the core, multinational corporations.
Okay. I'm going to take two more questions, and then we have to move on. Sorry. We'll give other people a chance, and then we have to wrap it up. So was there somebody over on that side?
Yes, there is. thank you both very much, or all three of you very, very much. My question is about team building to create strategies. It seems really obvious from the whole day and what we all know that there are a lot of, as you've said, Ralph, solutions, and it only takes a small group of people who can set aside their egos and work together. So with that little challenge, how do we do that?
There you go.
You take a change. What do you want to change? Who can make that change happen, apart from self-reliance and behavioral change that Bill was talking about? Let's say Congress is the only one that can really make that change the way our system is structured. And you start it in one congressional district. And if it works, you polish the model and you spread it, and it's easier than ever now through the internet, to other people. And start small. Everything starts with a conversation between two people, you know, throughout history. You start small, and you start the model. I hate to overdo a commercial model. That's the way McDonald's started. They started one McDonald's near Chicago, and they polished it and worked it and worked it. Then they had five, and then 10. And they reached a point where they could start McDonald's like punching it out. They had everything, how to get the real estate, how to get the employees, how to, you know, get the meat, how to process it, just like that. And we don't have that approach in the citizen movement. We are horrendously underorganized compared to the organization of these corporations. The biggest power these corporations have is their organizational intensity and stamina, because they have one yardstick: profit, sales, bonuses. They don't have to. There's no roaring debate inside ExxonMobil or Peabody Coal or whether they should go solar or, you know, fracking. They have that advantage over us because we're human beings are more nuanced. However, we are so underorganized, and part of it is the anathema to leadership. Now, Occupy Wall Street, bless them. They woke the country up on inequality and all. But they not only didn't believe in leaders, they didn't even believe in leadership. You know, everybody can be a leader in their own way. So they were so unorganized, the moment they were tossed out of Zuccotti Park, there wasn't anything. You have to connect with the power structure and take it over. And when you have 535 men and women who put their shoes on every day like you and I, members of Congress, shame on us that we can't take them back or replace them from the 1,500 corporations who get their way.
Bill, did you want to add something? Do you want to answer that?
Just to sort of complement that, the other work we got to do is build mass movements that change the zeitgeist. And when that happens, it gets lots easier to push these guys. If we look back in American history at examples like the Civil Rights Movement, a mass movement was able to change the flavor of the debate in this country to the degree that everybody came around eventually. And these are complementary strategies that we work on all the time. I guess I would say that given that the movement that we're working hardest on now, the climate change movement, given that we lack a great leader, a sort of Dr. King figure or something, I think it's really useful and helpful that we have instead this kind of sprawling protean kind of leaderless movement all over the world, because the thing that we're up against, the fossil fuel industry, is sprawling and protean and in every place, and it's good to be able to kind of resist them on every corner, and it's beginning to happen. There's a report coming out this week. Those of you who went and helped with this, what seemed like quixotic fight against the tar sands pipeline, the fight, our 3-year delay of Keystone's been enough to completely throw a financial wrench in the operation of that huge tar sands up there in Canada, and lots of companies have pulled out, and the same, there was a story in the trade papers a couple of months ago when the head of some one of these companies said, "We're never going to be allowed to build a pipeline in peace again." I thought, yeah, that's right. More power to it.
Okay. I'm going to take one more question. We're over time already. One more question and then closing remarks.
Thank you very much. Bill, you were exactly right. The march was so much fun. It was the best experience of my life. How many people were in the march on the 21st? Yeah, it was absolutely incredible. My question is, where do we go from here? The fossil fuel divestment campaign is picking up speed. It feels to me like everything is beginning to move at a geometric ratio. So where do we go from here? Your marches have been improving. So
I think you're right. I think that the single most effective campaign going around the world, there's a lot of this great work of playing defense against bad projects everywhere. That's got to go on. But the offense that's going on right now is this divestment campaign. And boy, is it picking up steam. You all know that the same night of that march, that night the Rockefellers announced that they were, if you've reached the point where the greatest fossil fuel fortune in the world has decided that they think it's immoral and unwise to be investing in this stuff, then what excuse does anybody else have? We're in the week since, big universities in Europe, in Australia have divested. It's reached the point where Exxon felt the need to put out a big statement explaining what a bad idea divestment was. So I'm quite encouraged as we go forward.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you
Can
so
I just
much.
Ask a question?
We're going to do, we're out of time.
Well, nobody's talked about the U.S. defense and the U.S. military and being the biggest.
We're going to talk about that in the next panel. That's why we want to get to it. We're going to do a one-minute wrap-up here.
That's completely true. The problem is not so much that the Army uses a lot of gas to drive its tanks around, okay? They do, but it's a tiny... the way we use energy and volume is that all of us use it. The problem is that they use it defending the world's supply of carbon, off in the Middle East. The minute that we get off that, then we have, then what we're going to use the Army for, unfortunately, for the next 100 years is helping clean up from one hurricane after another that we can no longer completely prevent. But that's the problem with what happens with the Pentagon, it seems to me. And I will add that there are at least some signs that people within the Pentagon as recently as today issuing reports explaining that the thing they fear most in the world at this point is climate destabilization. If nothing else, they pay some attention to reality, and they're beginning to understand just what a threat it is to be in a destabilizing world.
Okay, Ralph, do you have some closing statement?
Yeah, just a couple of quick, very quick points on the left-right alliance. Remember Richard Nixon. He signed into law the air and water pollution laws. He signed the EPA. He signed OSHA. He didn't want any of them. Why? Because on April 20, 1970, and the 5 days following, Earth Day, 20 million Americans participated in a scattered events all over the country. And he said, holy smokes, there are a lot of Republicans among them. He had his finger to the wind. There was a rumble from the people. And he signed all this legislation that he never otherwise would have signed with a flourish of rhetoric affirming it. So that's an example. When they get the signal that it's a left-right, they want to breathe free clean air, they want to drink clean water, eat safe food, left-right doesn't make any difference. The second is the new book out called GMO Deceptions, edited by Shelley Krimsky. Is Shelley here? Yeah. And I wrote an introduction to it, and I'm referring you to it because it provides the way to take apart a new dangerous technology that has not been held accountable. The kind of questions, the kind of yardsticks, the kind of skin in the game that these executives do not have. That's their process. It's total immunity. If Indian Point went meltdown and New York was radioactively contaminated, you think any of the heads of Indian Point would be prosecuted and sent to jail for life? Because they've been on notice. It's an aging plant. It's near earthquakes. They've been on notice and notice again, and all they keep doing is pushing out that nuclear-generated electricity. Left-right defeated the Clinch River Breeder Reactor in 1983. We were fighting it. It was a boondoggle funded by the U.S. taxpayer for Westinghouse and GE. We weren't getting anywhere. And Senator Bumpers from Arkansas called us up and said, why don't you connect with some of these right-wing groups? They think it's a waste of taxpayer dollars. And so we did, and we beat it 56-40 in a stunning upset in the U.S. Senate against against Reagan, against Senator Howard Baker, against Westinghouse, against General Electric. Last point is, if you read what David Freeman, who ran the TVA and three other public utilities in California and upstate New York, he says, think big. He's an engineer and a lawyer. He said, 3% replacement of fossil fuel and nuclear every year with renewables and efficiency. Very, very possible. Easily, as a matter of fact, if we redefined efficiency and productivity and available technology, within 35 years, we'd be completely a renewable energy-powered society. And that's, you see, within the frame of a lifetime, that's something you can get the younger generation to turn around on. And here's my favorite legal tender. You ever see a $2 bill? On the back is the room and where the people, where the white upper-income males assembled to sign the Declaration of Independence in July 4th, 1776. And why is this important? Because even though they were white upper-income males, they thought they were signing their death warrant, taking on the most powerful military headed by King George III. So the lesson of this, which should be distributed, you know, like Rockefeller distributed dimes, the first Rockefeller, to the young people. You say, aren't you glad these people showed up? When are you going to start showing up? Showing up is half of democracy, as Bill McKibben has proved.
All right. Thank you so much. Thank you so much.